The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Light of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish thought and practice based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKolel, Dean of the Kolel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America. This lecture, titled How to Really Appreciate Yourself, is dedicated to the memory and Le'ilui Nishmas Moshe Elozer ben Mordechai Olav Shalom, Mr. Morris Goldenberg of blessed memory.
First of all, good evening. Over the last 2.5 centuries, the world has seen unprecedented change and upheaval. Governments toppled and empires crumbled. New ideologies and social theories were conceived and gained adherence only to be ultimately discredited and rejected. The world was convulsed by the Napoleonic Wars of the 19th century and the two world wars of the 20th. All of this was accompanied with mass migration as the economic and political centers of power shifted across the globe. Within the countries themselves, there was a massive redistribution of population as the rural areas emptied out, millions attracted to the cities by the opportunities created in the wake of the Industrial Revolution. Despite enormous progress in technology and a tremendous rise in the overall standard of living, as a result of these social changes, mankind as a whole finds itself today less rooted, less secure, and subject to a plethora of psychological maladies. Although depression and a diminished sense of self-worth are as old as mankind itself, the first recorded case of depression is probably that of Cain, right before he killed his brother Abel. It seems that the cumulative events of the last 250 years have taken a severe and unprecedented psychological toll. Untold numbers of people crippled by a lack of self-esteem turn to alcohol, drugs, or other forms of mind-numbing activities or recreation to drown out feelings of worthlessness and dejection. The sense of security, purpose, and belonging that was once prevalent in the close-knit and stratified pre-modern society gave way to the insecurity of the competitive and frequently overwhelming modern world, where one is judged solely on his or her own merits, and more often than not, away from the comfort and help of an extended family. Not only does this quarter millennium witness the increasing sense of rootlessness and insecurity that came with the breakdown of the old structures of society, but also the existential crisis of modern man as organized religion, together with the belief in God and an afterlife, were seriously challenged. No longer completely assured of reward in the afterlife, mankind increasingly focused on seeking fulfillment in the here and now, with often disappointing psychological results. To best describe in detail the feelings often associated with a diminished sense of self-worth and self-esteem, and by comparison what it feels like when you do have a positive feeling about yourself, I would like to use the word depression, a psychological state that's often associated with a low self-esteem, not as a word itself, but as an acronym. Each letter in the word depression, there are 10 letters, spelling out another facet of life that is affected by the way we think about ourselves. In short, I'd like to show that having a healthy sense of self is not just something that's an extra, that it would be nice, but it seems it's essential to function in this world. The D, we're using this as an acronym, so the first idea, the D of depression, is decision making. When you have a positive attitude about yourself, You tend to be less fearful of failure and more willing to take risks and rely on your own judgment. On the other hand, if you don't think much about yourself, every failure is interpreted as a further indictment against your competence and ultimately your worth. You just can't afford to fail. People who lack a healthy self-image tend to be indecisive and avoid risk. That's D. E, the next, is enjoyment of life. When you have a healthy respect of your abilities and worth, you enjoy being alive all the more. Even when you're doing absolutely nothing, just being alive is something that can make you happy. With a lowered sense of self-worth, however, life can often be a real burden. You're constantly being reminded of your shortcomings. You look with jealousy at the others whom you view as your superiors and who seem to be having a wonderful time. And you're constantly wondering, why are you so cursed? So we have D is decision making and E is enjoyment of life. P of the word depression is performance. When you don't entertain any preconceived notions of your limitations, the sky is often the limit. And I'm reminded of the cartoon character that goes off a cliff and is going in midair and doesn't realize he's going on midair until finally he realizes and he falls down. But as long as he didn't realize his limitations, he kept on going. You're not afraid of failure because your attitude is, if I fail, so what? After all, there's much we learn from our mistakes, and every failure can be viewed as just another stepping stone towards success. Without the fear of failure, you can perform to your capacity. However, with a poor self-image, your view of yourself and your abilities and your fear of failure often becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. You fail because deep down you think that you're not very likely to succeed anyway. And you never muster the emotional strength to make the effort and to take the risks that spell success. So P is performance. R is respect. When you don't have self-respect, it's difficult to truly respect others. To a person suffering from a diminished sense of worth, the other person's special qualities are merely a bitter reminder of one's own shortcomings. That's why people with a low self-esteem tend to violate one of Judaism's cardinal sins, lashon hara, speaking ill and besmirching the reputation of others. We know that misery loves company. That's why it feels so good to put up down other people. But when you feel good about yourself, others are really no threat. Like the title of the bestseller, I'm okay, you're okay. So we have, again, D, decision-making, E, enjoyment of life, P, performance, R, respect. The next E is exert control. One of the ways that a person compensates for his low self-esteem is with the pleasure of the power that comes when one controls the lives of other people. By controlling others, the person is in effect saying, I'm a somebody. By creating a hierarchy of inferiors, you automatically become a superior. Unfortunately, such an approach not only creates untold psychological misery for the people whom they control, but ultimately only compounds the misery of the controller. They become universally hated and rejected. As parents, they create estranged children. And as employers, they create disgruntled and unproductive workers. If you feel good about yourself, however, you don't need to control others. You have the confidence to let others be themselves. They'll love you for it and make you feel even better about yourself. So the E is exert control. S is sin. When a person looks at him or herself as a person having a tremendous dignity and worth. Many of the common sins of mankind are unthinkable. As we say in Yiddish, it's pasnisht. It's unbecoming. You're too distinguished to lower and compromise yourself. But when you think of yourself as a loser, an ape with slightly more intelligence and less hair, you tend to be less fearful of sin. After all, you have so many faults, another thing or two will hardly matter. The next S is substance abuse. The underlying cause of much of the alcohol and drug addiction in the world is a lowered sense of worth and self-esteem. I mean, this is not always, but it's very often associated. You can't face yourself and your failings, and you therefore drown out your misery with some mind-numbing substance. Even after a person seeks help to rid the body of the ill effects of the substance abuse, the person still is in need of counseling to cope with the underlying causes that created the need in the first place. But if you feel good about yourself, there's no need to escape. In fact, it makes absolutely no sense. Life is too precious to destroy, and time is too valuable to kill. I is for individuality. When you feel good about yourself, you can be yourself. Not your neighbor, not your friend, not some popular figure that commands international respect and whose likeness is featured across the world. Just yourself. Because when you feel comfortable with yourself, you're not desperate for the approval of others. But when you don't think highly of yourself, you tend to lose your own identity and merely mirror the identity of others. You think that if you mimic those that are successful or liked, you yourself will be more accepted and your eyes more esteemed and worthy. Perhaps. Sometimes. But that esteem is often obtained at a very high cost. You spend your life trapped as an actor or chameleon, changing your appearance to fit the audience or occasion, a slave to the tastes and whims of others. The world may have gained a new star, but in the process, you've lost your own identity and sense of self-dignity and much of the happiness that life has to offer. O is opinions. Now we'll go over this again when we finish. People with a healthy view of themselves tend to be more confident and therefore not afraid to express their own opinions. Not that they feel they're necessarily always right, but they do feel that their opinions have enough merit to be openly discussed, if only to be ultimately dismissed in the final analysis. A person with a poor sense of self-worth, however, is often blocked from expressing his opinions on the basis of two imaginary fears. First of all, he's deathly afraid of having his opinion criticized and rejected. The last thing that a person with a fragile self-worth can tolerate is criticism. And secondly, the person very often mistakenly feels that he has nothing to offer. He, as well as the world, is the poorer for it. And finally, N is neurosis. A person who thinks of himself as unworthy is often plagued with all kinds of fears. Fear of failure. In his mind, every failure is a biting reminder of the incompetence, of his own incompetence, and only reinforces his own poor self-image. He's afraid of the fear. He has the fear of criticism, the fear of ridicule, the fear that he won't be liked, or that the dissatisfied spouse will walk out on them for a better mate, or an employer will fire them in order to hire a better employee. And those fears feed on themselves. They're often, as we've discussed before, a self-fulfilling prophecy, and often paralyze a person with inaction and indecision. People who think highly of themselves are less prone to these debilitating fears and neuroses. They can rationally assess their own good qualities and can be confident that others will see them as well. So let me go over this again. So 10 points, and they're important points. D, the first one, is decision making. E, enjoyment of life. P, performance. R, respect. E, exerting control. If you feel good about yourself, you don't need to control others. S, sin. If you respect yourself, you're not going to lower yourself. S, substance abuse. I, individuality. You can be yourself. This is O, opinions. You're not afraid to express your opinion. And N, neurosis. You don't have that much to fear. As you see, to fully live life to its fullest, it's incumbent to foster a healthy sense of self-worth and self-esteem. Otherwise, as we pointed out, one goes through life with a severe handicap and with much misery. As we pointed out before, although the feelings of inadequacy, diminished worth, and negative self-image have become more profound over the last few hundred years, the actual problems are as old as time itself. The solutions to these problems are very much part of Jewish tradition and scholarship, and as you will soon see, offer hope and a positive and refreshing outlook on life that transcends space and time. As you see, I hope all of you have a handout. From the first page of our handouts, I've divided the following talk. The title of this talk is Learning How to Truly Appreciate Yourself, into 10 parts, the title of each section beginning with a letter spelling the acronym APPRECIATE. So we dealt with 10 problems, and hopefully we'll deal with 10 solutions. The first, turn to page 2, of appreciate is Adam. And let me preface this. In this century, we've seen several movements in Russia, China, Germany, that's made the state the end-all and be-all of a person's life. Individuals aren't important in the statist view. It's the state. It's the masses. It's the nation. You give up your life for the nation. People aren't important. The greater organism called the nation or state is important. Even though this country was created on the basis of a very different philosophy. It was the philosophy of the individual. Those are those people who expanded this country, settled this country. But over the last century, as we become more sophisticated, where societies become more complex, where very often to get a job means to be part of a very large corporation, very large complex. We've developed now what's known as the organization man. There's a whole book titled Organization Man. Your worth is really defined as how you fit into the organization. I don't know how familiar you are with the motivational literature, which is the requirement of every manager to try to squeeze out every drop of productivity from the worker, and to con them, and to lift up their spirits, and to compliment them, and to prod them. But ultimately, it's for one goal, the benefit of the corporation. And every individual is a tool, is part of this enormous structure. I'd like to contrast these views with a quote that I have, and it's at the top of page 2. Therefore, this is taken from the Mishnah of Sanhedrin, this is Lamed Zayin Omed Aleph, 37a. Therefore, every single person is obligated to say, the world was created for my sake. A person is required to look at himself or herself as, hypothetically, if there would be no other people on earth, all you have is the vastness of the world, its teeming animal life and plant life, and perhaps the vestiges of civilization, the infrastructure, and you'd be the only person left. It would have been worth to create this whole world just for you, because you are that important. We're not diminishing the role of society. Last week we spoke about friendship. But there's one very important aspect of ourselves that's been diminished, that has become a casualty over the last 100 years or so. And that's the importance of yourself. And in the Jewish view, it says, every single person has infinite worth. You're not worth because you serve the state or the corporation or you serve your community. You have worth because you're yourself. So the first idea, the A of appreciate, is this notion which we're going to develop, is every single person has infinite worth. Humility is one of the most important character traits. It's the way through humility one could become, could reach the greatest spiritual heights. But very often humility is our greatest enemy, because we have this unrealistic view of ourselves, that who am I? I'm a nobody. And the Mishnah that we've quoted, it's part of the Talmud, says that you have to wake up every morning and say, the whole world was worth it just for me. So the A is Adam, Adam Rush. P of appreciate is potential. What could you make of yourself? We know we all have limitations. I don't know who in this room has the potential to be the world's next Mozart or Beethoven. Who's going to be the world's next Einstein? But there's a potential that we all share. And this is taken from a midrash, and perhaps it's the highest potential. And it's something, again, we're required to re-emphasize, to remind ourselves. And I like to quote this. It's taken from the Midrash Tana Deveil Yovel. It's in chapter 23. Therefore, everyone is required to say, when will my actions reach the heights of the actions of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? In the Torah, these are the patriarchs of the Jewish nation. God spoke to them. They reached the highest spiritual heights. For they acquired their portion in this world and the next only because of their good deeds and the study of Torah. And a person has to say, after all, I'm their grandchild. I'm from them. I'm part of this nation. There's a little bit of them in me. There's this vast, untapped potential that I have. And I have to ask myself, I have to make an assessment. Where am I holding? Where were they holding? And in what way can I improve myself? I just heard a speech last night. Now, this is the unfortunate the lot of people who give speeches. Very often, you have to listen to them as well. And I was a wonderful, wonderful speech. And it dealt with the portion that we read in the synagogues this last Shabbos. The story of Noah. Noah was a man who lived in a degenerate era. The land was full of deprivation, of degradation. They were depraved. It was full of violence. And here was one man who was not affected by his generation. And the person who gave the speech pointed out, it didn't suffice for Noah merely to be an honest person. You know, so he wasn't a man involved in violence. It didn't suffice for him to not just merely not to be a depraved person. He was a tzaddik tamim. He was a pure, righteous individual. He just didn't look at the ills of the generation and say, well, it's good enough that I don't suffer their ills. But he transcended his generation and says, but what could I personally become? Unfortunately, we have this tendency. We lull ourselves into this false sense of success. And so we look around, we look at the mass media, we see degeneration about us, the crimes, the dysfunctional families. And we could often point to our own lives and say, you know, I'm a lot better than a lot of people I read about. And we're lulled into, therefore, I'm a good person. And it may be very true, you are, each and every one of you, very good people. But are you reaching your potential? Because unfortunately, I mean, this is a unless you've personally experienced truly great spiritual people, or at least read about them, just reading newspapers and looking at the other forms of media, it's really hard to picture in your mind what does it mean to be a saintly person. But one thing is certain. Each one of us has a tremendous untapped potential. They used to say when I was a child about Albert Einstein that that each one of us has tremendous intellectual potential, that our brains are untapped. Here we're speaking about there's a spiritual greatness that each and every one of us potentially has that we're not tapping. And the first step to untap this potential is at least make the statement, I am here, my forefathers were there. Just what can I do to jump over the gap? What can I do? What's the first step at least? Then I can get a little closer to reach that potential. Because after all, if you think of yourself as just merely an intelligent ape, you know, your potential is quite limited. If you look at yourself as an angel, you know there's a lot of potential there that's not being tapped. You know, how many of us can look at ourselves and say we're truly angels? You know? So P is potential. So we have two. A, again, Adam, that man was this is this mission is prefaced by the fact that mankind was created not as a nation, not as a race. It was created with just one individual to show us the importance of every individual. If we'd be the only person on earth, it would be worth it all. And P is we have a tremendous untapped potential. The next P, as is called post-mortem. What happens after death? I remember a quote from Dag Hammarskjöld. Dag Hammarskjöld was the second Secretary General of the United Nations. And there's a quote from him that says that in the final analysis, how we view our future, what will happen to us after death, changes the whole way we look at life. And really, this is the point that we have quoted from the Mishnah and Avos here, the next P. That a person has to have in mind that there are two parts of every individual. This is really the Talmudic view. This is the Torah's view of mankind. We occupy a body. It may be beautifully formed, but it comes from very humble beginnings. But he says it comes from the initials, as the stages of the fetus, of the embryo, are very, very humble. And what happens to the body after we've lived a full life is also is nothing to write home about. But ultimately, there's part of us that survives bodily death. Our consciousness, according to the Torah's view, is in truth a spiritual essence. We are really spiritual beings. We occupy our bodies. We live life in our bodies. But when our body no longer functions, when the body dies, our consciousness still remains. We leave our body to go on to another plane. And ultimately, and this is something we'll dwell upon later on, we have to give, as in the end of this quote, an account and reckoning what we did when we had with all the opportunities that were given to us in our life. In the first lecture that I gave last May, and I don't want to spend much time on this, we discussed at length the vast research that has been done over the last 20-some years about all the evidence that strongly points to the existence of an afterlife. There was a book written a little over 20 years ago. It was a small book, but changed the lives of many people. Became overnight an international bestseller. And it was called Life After Life. After writing that book, Dr. Raymond Moody, who wrote the book, subsequently wrote several books afterwards, many other doctors, scientists, statisticians decided to research the subject. Dr. Moody, and probably all of you are familiar in some way with his work, discovered there were many people who were death's door. They were clinically declared dead. After being revived, told over a surprisingly similar story of having left their bodies. Many of them described not only leaving their bodies and being in the room, and they describe what happened in the operation in great detail, what happened when they left the room on occasion to go out in the hall, and describe in great detail what occurred outside of the room where they were being operated on. But many of them describe leaving this world and entering a transcendental plane, a spiritual world, and described a world which to a great degree is described in Jewish mystical texts. I would just like to give you, this is really, I'm quoting part of the book which I did not quote in the lecture in May. Just explain the feelings of those people and how they relate, those who've gone through this experience, how they relate to death, how they relate to themselves, how the experience changed them. And afterwards we'll describe what perhaps we could learn from all of this. And I'm quoting from the middle of the book, this is taken from page 91 in his first book, Life After Life. The reason why death is no longer frightening, as all of these excerpts express, he had quoted others who've gone through this who are no longer afraid of death. is that after his experience, a person no longer entertains any doubts about his survival of bodily death. It is no longer merely an abstract possibility to him, but a fact of his experience. Remember that much earlier, I discussed the annihilationist concept, annihilate, which uses sleeping and forgetting as its models of death. This is the secular view of death. In the secular view of death, our consciousness is the product of the chemical and electrical workings of our brain. When the brain ceases, the consciousness, the person ceases to exist. Persons who have quote-unquote died, in other words, those who have reported to Dr. Moody, in other words, he's interviewed, disavow models like this and choose analogies which portray death as a transition from one state to another, or as an entry into a higher state of consciousness or of being. One woman whose deceased relatives were there to greet her at her death, and this is a concept which is described as well in the Zohar, which is the classic Jewish mystical text, compared death to a homecoming. Others have likened it to other psychologically positive states, for example, to awakening, to graduating, to escape from jail, and he quotes just two of them, which I'd like to read to you. Some say that we are not using the word quote-unquote death because we're trying to escape from it. That's not true in my case. After you've once had the experience that I've had, you know in your heart that there's no such a thing as death. You just graduate from one thing to another, like from grammar school to high school to college. That's one quote. Another quote, another person. Life is like imprisonment. In this state, we just can't understand what prisons these bodies are. Death is such a relief, a release, like an escape from a prison. That's the best thing I can think of to compare it to. When you look at yourself, that you're a spiritual being occupying a physical body. Your origins are not merely from the cellular matter of your father and mother, but you come from a spiritual plane originally. You entered this world, you will leave this world. You're graduating, or as the other person explained it, while you're in this body, you're imprisoned. You look at life totally different. It isn't just a question of how you look at death, but it's how you view life itself. I'd like to tell over a story that I told in the first lecture that I gave in May. One of the great rabbis of pre-World War II Europe was Yisroel Meir HaKohen Kagan. He was known as the Chofetz Chaim by the original work that he made. He was a writer of many books, but this was his first work, and it deals with the laws of respecting other people and not besmirching them or speaking ill of them. He was known far and wide, Chofetz Chaim. And there was a certain individual whose roots were in the old world, come from Eastern Europe, came to America, made his fortune, and as he grew older, wanted again to see the world that he grew up in as a child. And having heard about the Chofetz Chaim, he made the trip while he was in Poland to the city, the town of Radom, to see this great man. And when he walked into the home of the Chofetz Chaim, he was shocked. The Chofetz Chaim had no furniture. And he had tables and chairs, but he didn't have furniture. And he was shocked that a person who's known throughout the world should live in such poverty. And he couldn't control himself as he's speaking to the Chofetz Chaim. This man said, Rebbe, says, Avu is our mebel. Rabbi, where's your furniture? as I heard the story originally, the Chofetz Chaim didn't answer immediately. But further on in the conversation, he asked, by the way, I forgot to ask you. He says, where's your furniture? He says, I don't see your furniture. My furniture? It's back home in Chicago. I'm just passing through. He says, I'm also just passing through. If you're passing through, a lot of the... your view is that many of the things that the disappointments of life, all those things you never acquired, all those vacations you never took, all those honors that were not heaped upon you, really don't matter that much anyway, because after all, you're just passing through. You'd be going on a train ride, you're going through I remember as a child I went across country on a train, it's 3 days it took. You don't really worry about the accommodations, because you know that eventually, when you're going to get to your destination, everything's going to be fine. I mean, you like it to be nice, but it's all not that important. If you're looking at life that you're just passing through, many of life's disappointments take on a different hue and color. So again, A is Adam. That each one of us is important. And if we'd be the only person on earth, it would be worth it all. P is we have a tremendous spiritual potential. The next P, post-mortem, is that we don't just live in this world. We're in this world now. We have to make the most of it. Tremendous opportunities are in this world. But this is not our final destination. We're just passing through. R of appreciate is reward. Really, and this puts it into perspective. If we're just passing through, what's life all about? You know, some people are blessed with wonderful scenery. You know, it's worthwhile to go on a train ride across the country just to look out the window. I remember as a child and seeing the cornfields and in Iowa, and you're going through, you just see that this country as it changes. But not everybody in life has such a wonderful view of life. What are we doing? What are we supposed to do when we're passing through life? And again, this is the view of the Talmud, the view of the Torah. And really, I'd like to quote, this is the Mishnah here, which really says it all. This is taken again from Avos. This is from the fourth chapter. Rav Yaakov said, this world is likened to a vestibule before the world to come. Prepare thyself in the vestibule. The vestibule. As, like, you know, when you're going, you're supposed to go to a chasana. You know, you're supposed to go to I remember, says, we married off, says, Anna and Hari married 3 kids off. Every time we have to go to the hall before, we have to get ready, you know, and we have the pictures. It's, I don't know if you've gone through this, the gefilte. It says, you go, and you come there, you know, I don't know how well you prepared you are before you come there, but you're given a room, and you know, mepus zechois, you know, you get all ready. It says, that's what a vestibule is. You're entering this great hall, the Prozdor. And you have to get ready. And the purpose, what we're doing here, is putting our lives in order. And I'd like to continue. He used to say, more beautiful is 1 hour spent in repentance and good deeds in this world than all of the world to come. And more beautiful is 1 hour of spiritual bliss in the world to come than all of the pleasures of this world. It's a very profound statement, and let me just dwell on this briefly. All of those who've gone through a near-death experience and who've claimed that they've left this world to go to the other world have no words to express the infinite pleasure it is in the next world. They don't have words to express. Not that they've seen the total experience. After all, they didn't truly die. Basically, when a person dies, a person is given a preview. And it reminds me, I don't know if I told this story the first time, but I have to tell this story. It's a great story. Even though it may not. The story goes, this is an apocryphal story. It's a great story anyway. The story goes that David Ben-Gurion, 3 weeks before he died, had a dream. And in that dream, he died. And his soul went up to the other world. And he came in front of three sages, the court of the world to come, where he was judged. And they made the following speech to him. They said, "Since you're the prime minister of the Jewish state, we're going to offer to you a privilege that's offered to no man. Normally, we declare the sentence, but we're going to make you make the decision." Ben Gurion's been a kluger yid, you know, he was quite intelligent. He's not a flip a coin. He says, "Show me." He wasn't from Missouri, but, you know, he wanted to be shown. So first they showed him heaven. And heaven was this big yeshiva. And they were learning, and he said, "I've seen enough. Show me the other place." And they take him to the other place. And it is wonderful. And people are having a great time. And they're laughing, and there's music, and there's drinking, and they're having a ball. And with this, says Ben-Gurion, wakes up. 3 weeks to the day, David Ben-Gurion dies. And the scene that occurred, that he saw in his dream, was replayed. It all happened. His soul, he left his body. He went up to the great tribunal in heaven. The three sages that he had seen in his dream, he saw there. The same speech that since he's the prime minister of the Jewish state, is being afforded this privilege that no man has ever been afforded. He will choose whether to go to heaven or the other place. He doesn't equivocate. He doesn't stall. He's firm. The other place. And they take him to the other place. And it's hot. And it's terrible. And they're screaming. And it's miserable. And he turns to his angel guide. And he says, "Wait a minute. That's not the place they showed me before." And the angel thought for a minute and left. "Ah, that must be the place they show the tourists." Those who've had a near-death experience didn't truly die. They were shown a taste of the other world. The paths their lives would take afterwards were not shown to them. They were shown a taste of the potential good. But what they come back and tell us is amazing. And really, this is the last sentence here on page 2. "More beautiful is 1 hour of spiritual bliss in the world to come than all of the pleasures of this world." But yet, look at the preceding sentence. "More beautiful is 1 hour spent in repentance and good deeds in this world than all of the life of the world to come." In the world to come, we reap the produce of all that we've created in this world. But here, while we're alive, we're creators. We create the world to come. It isn't St. Peter standing there by the pearly gates and lets everybody in and everyone has an equal share and doesn't make a difference what you've done. You create this world. In fact, there's a quote, there's a Gemara in Bava Basra. This is in the 75A in Hei Amud Aleph, that says, "In the world to come, every saint has his place. and is metaphorically, he's singed by the greatness of his fellow saint. Every saint has special qualities. Every saint has a special place. The place of one is not the place of another. And, you know, they feel bad in a sense. So, you know, I don't have what he has. But on the other hand, the other one doesn't have what he has. Everyone has taken a different path in life. Everyone has created his own heaven. We create our own heaven. It isn't a place you just walk in. We create it. And every deed that we do builds another brick. And ultimately, it's the accumulation of these bricks and how we put them together that defines what life will be in the hereafter. Unfortunately, and this, again, this view of life, of the greatness of man, of man's tremendous potential, because what we're here for in this life, therefore, is to transform ourselves. We're spiritual beings that are unformed, so to speak. It's like a lump of clay or a block of marble that has to be chiseled and formed. Each one of us forms that block in a different way. But we have to put in the effort in this world to make those changes. But the potential is enormous. That was the first P. And the reward of what we will eventually have for all our efforts is indescribable. But to best to make it an analogy of the dynamics of this world, and perhaps why is it that so many of us never reach our spiritual potential? I'd like to tell you the following story. We spoke about the Chofetz Chaim. The Chofetz Chaim told over the following story. It's a mashal. It's a parable. A man heard of an island in the South Seas. It was a volcanic atoll that, because of the positioning and what had erupted there, was full of brilliant gems. Gems that were almost unlike any on the face of the globe. And having heard about this, and thinking of how much money, how much wealth he could accumulate by going there and collecting these gems, he arranged transport on a freighter to travel that area, and at that time, it only went there once a year. He booked passage on the freighter, made the long, arduous trip, and finally came to this island. And it was as exactly as he was told. The very streets were paved, were lined like a street would be lined with gravel on a rural road. These were lined with these gems. And he never saw anything like this. And he started filling up his pockets. And he filled this pocket up and that pocket and the shirt pocket. And he didn't know what to do. His hat. And the people, the natives, looked at him, started laughing. He looked at him like he's crazy. He's here. This stuff is worthless. You know what's worth in this island? What we need is oil. There's no oil here. There's a few palm trees. There's a dearth of oil. The one who can control the oil market, he is the king. And he looked at himself, you know. Everyone's laughing at him. He had these bulging pockets. He started emptying out his pockets and he threw them. You know, the diamonds and the rubies and the emeralds and the sapphires and the garnets. He was just throwing them out. And he was going to, and he saw the problems of oil, and he thought of a brilliant method how to extract oil in a greater economical way. I may have changed the Chofetz Chaim story a little bit. You'll have to forgive me. But he says, in a greater economical way, and he put all his efforts, that eventually, he says, He created storehouses of this oil. So at the end of the year, when he was planning, he had a book passage on the freighter back. He totally forgot about all these gems. And he filled the freighter with barrels upon barrel of the oil that he had extracted on this island. And again, says he made the long trip back home. I mean, he was on the island, he was a king. I mean, he had just all this oil. And he took it with him on the freighter. He comes back home, and he takes it, says, off the boat. And then he feels so proud, and his family looks at him and says, what did you do the year you're away from us? We missed you so. He says, I collected oil. And they look at him, he's a meshugan. He says, oil? Yeah. He says, show us. And they looked at it. By the time they opened it up, the oil had turned rancid already. And then he remembered, hey, wait a minute, what did I do here? I spent all that year just collecting oil. What a failure. And he tapped his pocket, and there was still just a few of those gems that he originally collected that he'd thrown out. And it was from those few gems that he was able to at least live comfortably for the rest of his life. That's the story. The analogy, the nimshal, is our life. We come from heaven. Not exactly via freighter, but something like it. We come out. We have all this potential. In this world, we can accumulate such spirituality, so many mitzvahs. We can broaden our knowledge, our wisdom. But everyone's running after fats, and everyone's after oil. You know, the schmaltz. You know, this one has it in this way and that way, and they're busy collecting. And we forget ourselves. And we get carried away by the frenzy of the world around us. And we're also busy collecting all of this stuff. But by the time it's time that we're shipped back home, and the freighter comes to take us back, all those fats just turn rancid. We can't take it with us. All the collection of our art, and all the money that we've deposited in accounts, we leave here. It's those few mitzvahs that we've done. It's that spirituality that we have, that potential, that tremendous potential we have that we've tapped, that we bring with us to the other side. That's the ultimate wealth that we create. The reason we don't tap our spiritual wealth, because unfortunately we take it for granted. Because that ultimately, if we're just passing through, we're just as afraid to come take us back. Ultimately, the true wealth is spirituality. I'd like to add another mashal here and then continue on. Another little story. If a person looks at himself in life and thinks, what is he compared to his neighbor? I think the most apt analogy is the following story, folk story. It's a little saying. You know, in last week I spoke extensively about beggars. There was another figure that was a prominent figure in society in Eastern Europe. That was the Melamed. It was the village teacher. Education amongst the Jews was the highest priority. And he played a tremendous role, but unfortunately, because of the poverty that was widespread, there was very little financial remuneration for all his efforts. He eked out a living. And the story is told about the village Melamed, about the teacher in the village, who once commented, you know, if I had Rothschild's wealth, I'd be even wealthier than Rothschild. He asked him, why? Because I do a little teaching on the side. Of course, the joke here, or the what it's pointing out, is really to the parochial view of this village teacher, is that if you have all that wealth, A few more piastres really doesn't make a whole lot of difference. We've described a human being as an angel, a man, a person of tremendous potential, a person that creates wealth just by thinking, by helping others, by contemplating. Each one of us has untold wealth. But we look at ourselves like that village teacher. Because besides all the wealth that I have, I also happen to have a job on the side. I have a little home here, or a few homes. Or I have money here, I do this, or I go out there. Compared to the tremendous wealth that we all have, it's nothing. It's like, besides, you have one pocket is full of gold coins and the other pocket is full of marbles. If you have gold coins, you don't have to count how many marbles you have. You may be lacking a few marbles. You've got if you have your marbles. You don't have to count the marbles you have. Because if you have these gold coins, well, it doesn't make a difference. Each one of us is tremendous. Each one of us is an angel. We are great and we can become immensely greater. And when we look at our neighbor who has something that we don't have, whether it be talents or looks or honor or success, they're marbles. Because ultimately, if you really appreciated yourself, you know you have a wealth that can't be measured. So the R of appreciate is reward. I know my wife is getting worried here. We're going to go over time. E is evolution. We're all familiar with the theory of evolution. In the Jewish view, all of the world that existed before man was only created as a backdrop for the activities of man. Not necessarily, I mean this partially of course, but not just to build buildings and conquer continents. But the world that was placed for man on this planet was a means for him to utilize and to grow. As if you could look, at the quote here on top of page 3, about a person, we're thinking about a spiritual person, a person who has a sense of spirituality, has the fear of God, has the sense of godliness in the world. He says, the whole world was created for his sake. That's what the whole world is all about. There's one quote. Abba Bar Kahana says, he is equal in value to the whole world. I mean, he is the world. Every human being is worth the whole world. Shimon ben Azai says the whole world was created as a satellite for him, only as to accompany him. A person who's aware of their spirituality realizes that everything that was done beforehand, all of life that came, emerged on this planet, and everything that's here historically is a backdrop for his use to help him further his own growth. And it's not just the fact of the trees and the sand and the stones and the buildings. I'd like to share with you the Chofetz Chaim is quoted to have said regarding the inventions that were created in his time. Says that it gives a person a greater feeling of what the spiritual world is, the dynamics of the spiritual world. And a story is associated with this. The Chofetz Chaim is supposed, I don't know if the story is true, but it's supposed to have been scheduled to catch a train at a certain hour. The train was supposed to take him to a city where he was planning to speak, and there were people waiting for him. Unfortunately, he came a few seconds late. He missed the train. And as a result of missing the train, he had to phone, he had to really telegraph, you know, ahead, you know, to tell them not to wait for him because he had to be rescheduled. According to the story, he had to phone, I guess, to his hometown to tell them, you know, about what had occurred. And they asked him, "What did you learn from all of this?" And he replied, "You know, I learned three things. From the train, I realized, you know, sometimes," says, "you know, if you miss it by a minute, if you don't seize the opportunity, you're a little late, you miss everything. Don't wait for the last minute. Because if you wait too long, you're going to miss it. The second thing is, I realized from the telephone, you know, there's a view and taken from the Talmud, that everything that we say is recorded. We're being observed, so to speak." You know, he says, "I realize, you know, even though there's a distance on a telephone, I speak here, but they're listening over there. And from the telegraph, I realize, you know, every word costs. You have to be careful what you say. If the Chofetz Chaim would be alive today, perhaps he would find something else to learn from what's been created." Now, this is about evolution. What's been created in our world? We have a world of computers. You can type on a computer keyboard, and all you just see is just a depression of the keys. In reality, you're making vast changes in the electromagnetic composition of the disk that you're writing on. You don't see those changes. All you see is you're pressing keys. But you are making tremendous changes. I know this firsthand because my son once pressed the delete key and we lost files and files. Let me tell you. Be careful as to how you press those keys. In the Talmud's view, every mitzvah that we do has a tremendous effect on the spiritual world. God didn't create, in the Talmudic view, in the Kabbalistic view, only one world. He created worlds upon worlds. And everything we do in this world has an effect, has a spiritual effect on all the other worlds. We are creators. Really, this comes to the C, the creativity. Man was created in the image of God. And one of the explanations of the image of God, and this is taken from Reb Chaim Volozhiner. Reb Chaim Volozhiner was one of the great disciples of the Gaon of Vilna. And in his work, Nefesh HaChaim, he explains that God is a creator. We are all mini-gods. We all create. But that creation takes place on a plane that we don't see. I mean, part of that, of course, is we transform our own psyche. But there's some of it which takes place on a plane that we don't see. And perhaps if the Chofetz Chaim would be alive today, he would liken it to pressing, says the putting your fingers and pressing your keys, your hands on the keyboard. You press this and that and the other thing, you're making vast changes on the disk in the computer. We are making every mitzvah. We can't underestimate what we have, the potential that every human being has. Not only do we look ourselves as angels, but we are creators as well. You know, there's a midrash that explains that the angels at creation were afraid, didn't want Moshe to get the Torah. The Torah should remain above, shouldn't go down to mankind. And one of the commentators explains, because once mankind has the Torah, mankind has the power to influence change the entire universe, including the spiritual universe. The lives of the angels are affected by what we do here. We don't see it. We see that we give tzedakah to the poor, we say a good word to this person, and we lend a helping hand to the other person. We spend the time, we take the time off, perhaps, to broaden our horizons, gain wisdom and knowledge. We don't see the effects of this. But in truth, what's occurring is like on the keyboard of that computer. You're making tremendous changes. Ultimately, the world that we inherit after we die, the world to come, is the product of all these changes. So C is creativity. I is inspiration. Then mankind has, in a certain sense, every human being has the potential of psychic qualities. He has the potential of having a communication from a higher world. Very few of us tap that. But to the sense that we grow spiritually, we could access an inspiration, ideas that aren't our own. And that's the I, says inspiration. A is aspirations. What's going to happen afterwards? And it says that each one of us has to give an account and reckoning before the King of Kings, the Holy One, blessed be He. And you know, this Mishnah tells us something very important. It tells us two things. But the thing I want to dwell on over here, on this particular, is that we are going to be judged by God. You know, it seems we're very important. You know, someone does a minor crime, is judged by a judge who's the local superior court or some local, some local court. If one does a crime of major proportions, or one does a good deed of major proportions, then one has an audience with someone higher up. The more important you are, and the more important the deeds that you do are reflected, that who comes and judges you? Who looks at you? Who is going to say something to you afterwards? It says, God cares for each and every one of us. The one who created the world looks at each and every one of us as we are, as we started before, the only person on earth. And treats us with the greatest respect. And we come to be judged, hopefully, since we have much to show for our life on earth. But there's another side, that the one who gave us all this life, all these opportunities, looks at us, as a little disappointed. I gave all of this to you. Why didn't you take all these opportunities? But he'll be there. It reminds me of the story. Just want to see how late I'm running. It reminds me of the story, and probably many of you have heard this already, of a person who lived in a town who the dam that was holding the river by the town says broke. The levees broke. The town was inundated. The streets were filled with water and it was rising. And people lived in colonial homes and went from the first story to the second story, and it was still rising. The cars were floating across the streets. Says already the local authorities have been called. So people were coming. Were coming with boats, to help the people that hadn't gone to high ground before. Says, and the person who had been stuck in his house, and as the thing at rising, went up from the second story, climbed the stairs, and went on top of the roof, and was waiting for help. And he thought to himself, you know what? I've done a lot of good things in my life. I want God to help me. And he prayed to God, says, God, show me your hand. Just save me. And the water is going higher and higher. It was already on the top of his roof. He was holding on. And someone with a rowboat came. He says, come on. He says, no. Just, God's going to help me. I know it. You know, and the guy rows further on and it's going. The water is rising. And further on, someone in a motorboat is coming. And he comes next to him and, you know, gives out his hand, says, you know, grab hold of me. He says, I'll take you onto my boat. He says, no. He says, I'm okay. He says, God's going to take care of me. And the rising, it's rising already up to his neck, the water. And there was a helicopter that came down, lowered a ladder. And from the loudspeaker says, you know, grab hold of the ladder. You know, come up. He was the last man already who hadn't been taken by all the boats. He says, no, don't worry. He says, I'll be okay. God's going to take care of me. Ultimately, says, the water rose. He lost his grip on the roof. And eventually the man drowned. And when he came up to heaven, in front of the heavenly tribunal, and God was there, and he looked at God with great disappointment, and he said, where were you when I needed you? I hoped, I prayed, says, I was sure you'd come and help me. And God told him, so what do you mean? I sent you two boats and a helicopter. Life is full of tremendous opportunities. We just have to realize it, that everything that comes our way, but would be clearly blessings, and that which is clearly challenges, is sent by God. Finally, T is Torah. It says we all have to be tremendously thankful that we're given a means as Jews. So we're given a means, a guide. Torah means a guide, an outline of what's important in life, what's not important in life. Then E, last E of appreciate, is expectations. And again, if you look, the time doesn't allow, it goes through the whole judgment process. I'd like to just touch upon the last part of the judgment process. But before I do, and that will end the class, I'd like to just summarize what we covered. We started off this class lecture describing what are the ills of a person who does not have a positive attitude about himself. And we went through the acronym, right, of depression. Let me just, again, just quickly go over this. The D is decision making. You know, if you don't have confidence, you think you're a nobody, it's very difficult for you to be decisive. E is enjoyment. If you look at yourself as a failure in life, it's very hard to enjoy life. P is performance. Again, if you don't have confidence in yourself, you're not going to perform to your maximum. R, respect. If you don't respect yourself, you're not going to respect others. E, exert control. If you can make people's lives, if you don't feel good about yourself, you try to compensate very often by pushing yourself upon others with disastrous results. S is sin. If you don't think highly of yourself, it's not beneath you to lower yourself, you know, and to do things that really, says, are really beneath your dignity. S is substance abuse. If you feel terrible about yourself, very often you want to drown out your feelings about life. So you become numb. I is individuality. So if you don't feel you're in anything, you have to be a chameleon and copy everybody else. You can't be yourself. oaths, as opinions. If you have a diminished sense of self-worth, you're afraid to utter an opinion amongst others. Really, you don't feel that it's worth anything. And second of all, you can't face being criticized. And N is neurosis. It's because of the fears that you have, the fear of failure, which in a large amount stems from this distorted view of yourself. You have all kinds of fears and sadness and misery that plagues you through your life. We contrasted this with the Jewish view. And in short, the Jewish view is that we are all spiritual beings. Each one of us is an angel of infinite worth. And that God is worried about us. And all of life here are challenges. And what life is all about is to transform ourselves. We're spiritual beings to make us more refined spiritual beings. We're great. We can be very proud of ourselves. And that's what APPRECIATE, we really had we took the acronym APPRECIATE. A is for Adam. If we'd be the only person on earth, it would be worth it all. P is potential. Each one has a tremendous spiritual potential, very often untapped. P, post-mortem, that we're just passing through life. Our spirit will survive, our conscience will survive bodily death. Our reward, what we do here in this world, it says, defines what will happen to us in the next world. E, evolution, all that was created in this world is just for us. You know, we in the process of evolution, we are the crown of the process. And there's really much to be learned, even the constant evolution of technological developments, there's much even to see from this to learn. C, creativity. We create whole spiritual worlds. We may not see it like pressing the keys on the computer keyboard, but we have tremendous power. So I, inspiration, it's possible for a person to grow spiritually, to be a person who's in tune and could, in a certain sense, be communicated, gets the inspiration from a divine source. A, aspirations. We speak about the idea that we're going to be judged but by God Himself because we are so important to Him. T, Torah. We have a guideline. And E, expectations. What can we expect ultimately in the other world? And I quoted about the whole judgment process. I'd like to tell you a little story. You know, one of the founders of the Russian Revolution was a man by the name of Leon Trotsky. He was Jewish. He got a Jewish education, like many young Jewish children in Eastern Europe. Evidently, he was a revolutionary. He must have been a terror for his teachers as well. He must have given them a terrible time. But they turned him off. And one of the great rabbis in Europe said, his name is Alter of Nevada, Rav Yosef Yezel Horovitz, he says, that the teacher that turned that man off will have to, and says, I don't envy that person and his judgment. Because he thinks all he did was just turned off a small little child. What he did was responsible. He was that melamed. I guess the last time was beggars. This one is melamed in here. This is teachers. Says, that village teacher says, who was the cause that Trotsky left the life of Torah and became a revolutionary. He has on his shoulders all of the casualties, the deaths, and the hunger and pogroms that came about as a result of the Russian Revolution. We have a tremendous potential not only just to change ourselves, but to change the world. And we will have to give an accounting for what we've done. The flip side of that is, I don't know if I've given this in a previous lecture. Take a person like Rashi. Rashi would be probably the greatest teacher. Definitely from Moshe, Moses, is the greatest teacher in Klal Yisrael, amongst the Jewish people. Anyone who's a student of the Torah is automatically a student of Rashi's. His is the major commentary. Anyone who's a student of the Talmud is a student of Rashi. We can only measure the goodness that Rashi did in this world, not in his own lifetime, but at the end, very end of history, when the accumulated good can only come and be accounted for. You know, the language is, says, and this is from the quote, we are going to be given a din v'cheshbon, a judgment and accounting. One of the explanations is we are judged for what we've done directly. But there's an accounting of all that we've indirectly done, good and not good. We just don't affect our lives, but each one of us has a tremendous effect on the lives of others. And let me end off with the following story. Again, it says, as I said, it says, those who often speak, it says, are fated to hear the speeches of others. At a dinner that I was at, the guest speaker told over the following story. He's a rabbi, and his name is Rabbi Shapiro. He's a rabbi north of Miami Beach. And when he was a young man in the 1950s, he visited a kiosk. He was in Tel Aviv, and there was a man. It was a kiosk, and you know, it was selling newspapers, cigarettes, and it was Friday afternoon. And he was standing from afar and viewing what occurred. And he saw the man was like his face was down the whole time. When a customer would come, he would lift up his face. And someone asked for a pack of cigarettes, and he looked at his watch, and it was Friday, 12 o'clock. He says, he doesn't sell cigarettes after 12 on Friday. But then he's afraid the person's going to smoke them on Shabbos, so he didn't want to sell them. He says, you know, this guy's an unusual person here. I want to see, what kind of person is this? He comes a little closer, and he saw that he was looking into a sefer. He was looking into a Jewish book. And he started speaking to him. And it came that this person, the kiosk owner, it was an elderly man, originally came from Minsk, which is today in Belarus. And he told us, he asked this, Rabbi Shapiro was a young man then, where he came from, and he says, you know, he's learning in Yerushalayim, Jerusalem, but he had just came from the city of Lakewood, New Jersey, or in the yeshiva, and he asked him, who's the head of the yeshiva? And he told him, this is Rav Aaron Kotler, this is the Rosh Yeshiva, the head of the yeshiva. And he said, you know, I always wondered what became of him. He says, I was a butcher in Minsk. And I had a thing that whenever I would buy a piece of meat, you know, I would put in a penny in the pushka, you know, in the tzedakah box. And whenever I'd make a sale, I'd put another penny. And the butchers, very often those tradespeople, you know, had their own shuls, had their own synagogues. So the accumulated monies, everybody, his pushka was full, he went over one day to take it to the shul. And he saw two young men learning in the synagogue. And he asked them what they're doing, and they were learning evidently they were very advanced, and they were very young age. And he said, what are you doing in Minsk? You know, there are not many opportunities for young men like you here. You should go to the yeshiva Slabotka, Slabotka was a suburb of Kovno. At that time it was a tremendous yeshiva. And he said, you'll grow there, go there. He says, we can't afford it. He says, he took out the money of the pushka. He gave him the money. He says, take this money, buy yourself a train ticket. He says, and go to the yeshiva. I always wonder what happened with that young man. I see he developed nicely. He went on to head the yeshiva. So the Rabbi Shapiro said, you know, he was addressing the audience, and he made the comment, you know, it's interesting. That person, because of all the pennies he put together and gave finally to these two young men, was responsible for much of the Torah that exists today in America. The Lakewood Yeshiva, there's thousands of students. They have rabbinical positions and teaching positions across the globe. The other young man was Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, that's all. who became a great Rosh Hashiva in New York. That one little action affected the lives of so many people. The problem with us is that we don't appreciate ourselves. Because God, in His infinite goodness, gives us tremendous opportunities constantly to change ourselves and to change the world. And if we realize how truly great we are, and how truly God is concerned with us, and like rooting for us, wants to live up this potential, we would start thinking in those terms. Hey, wait a minute. You know, I'm a great person. I can do great things. I can affect great. I can affect the world. And B, all the kleinigkeit, all the small petty things of how much money you make, or how your looks are, or your job success, or this or that, are like the marbles. You have diamonds and rubies in your pockets. If we would start thinking about our true greatness, we would be very happy with ourselves. Tremendous potential, tremendous responsibility, but we would never look at ourselves as inferior.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237.